I just want to do God's will.
The kind of revolution that the world needs is a Christian revolution.
If you want a miracle, you've got to expect it to happen.
You're the recipients of God's grace and God's blessings, and you rejoice in that reality.
Welcome to Life Today Live. Randy Robinson here. Great to have you. And you know, it is an election year. And you know what that means. It means lots of brotherly love and civil conversations and just sharing our thoughts with each other as we all work towards this great American experiment to build our country in a way that's compassionate and strong. Or at least that's what I wish it was about. And instead, it becomes a little crazy. And you know, I'm an insider. I'm a Christian. I work in ministry. I'll just go ahead and say it. Sometimes we Christians lose our minds around election time. We just do. Let's be honest. Well, we're going to talk about maybe how to not lose our minds, how to maybe, I don't know, renew our minds during this election season. And that doesn't mean abdicate the gift of participation that we have here in America at all. But that means just keeping the main things, and just kind of keeping the order of things right. And I've got a guest today. He has a book called The Party Crasher. It's available. Looks just like this. And Joshua Ryan Butler is the author. He's also a teaching pastor with a group of churches up in the Portland area, a Willamette Christian Church, if you are a Portland kind of person. I don't know everything in the book because I've just got the notes on it. So we'll see. We'll have a good conversation. And here's the thing. We need to be able to have good conversations. And if Joshua and I happen to disagree on something, we can both say so and then go to take it in prayer. But keep in mind that we're on Team Jesus, period. Right? Yeah. Okay, I'll quit preaching because I could. I'll let Joshua do his thing. Joshua, welcome to Life Today Live. Great to have you.
Thank you so much, Randy. So great for the conversation, man.
So what is the conversation in your mind? Because this is, you know, you don't talk about religion and politics. Yeah, we're going to do both, right? But what is the right conversation?
Totally. Well, you know, backdrop for this book, so that, you know, The Party Crasher, How Jesus Disrupts Politics as Usual and Redeems Our Partisan Divide. And the backdrop for me was just going, man, we all know that we're more polarized than ever, and we're seeing it fracture the political polarization. It's fracturing families, it's fracturing friendships, it's fracturing churches. I've been a pastor for a little over 20 years, and the last two election seasons have just felt more divisive than ever. And so, you know, kind of a story I open with at the beginning of the book is a church that we were very close friends with, a church in our network, and they split in half over political division. There were 1,500 out of 3,000 people that left and left angry. And part of the backdrop to this was just one of the pastors on staff had put a short video on Instagram, kind of sharing some thoughts to kind of try and shepherd his people in one area, and that got read by a certain crowd through kind of their ideological grid, things he wasn't even saying, but kind of got accused of saying. And there were about 7-8 people at the church who started a campaign they left and left angry and started a campaign to try and take down the church. They began scouring every church in the network. There were 10 churches in the network. They began scouring every pastor's sermons, looking for any ammunition. They began scouring elders and pastors, their spouses, social media feeds, like looking for ammunition. There was like a video that came out saying one of the pastors, you know, the lead pastor was under the influence of Satan. And dude, there was slander, gossip, just stuff that wasn't even flat out was not even true. And it was just crazy how big it blew up where there was just no substance underneath it, you know, and yet, given the divisive moment that we're in, you could feel that the suspicions were through the roof and people were just, you know, prone to suspicion and all. And so anyways, man, seeing that happen, and I wish that I could say that was a one-off event, that church kind of fracturing and splitting in half. But, you know, I know friends of mine around the country who are leading in churches and have seen the same thing happen, story after story of churches fracturing along political fault lines. And knowing families, we're going to Thanksgiving dinner now, it can feel like going into World War III or something, you know, like just, and so I think for me, the question was, you know, as a follower of Jesus, how do we put Jesus at the center? And what does it look like to, as you said, not to abdicate involvement in politics, but to do so with the maturity and humility that has Jesus first, that can keep us united at the table in a world that's coming apart? You know, how can Jesus bring us together in a world that's coming apart?
Yeah, and you know, what I don't know the situation with the pastor that you're talking about, but even if he had said something that you disagree with, that's not how you handle it as a Christian, right? Yeah. You know, and there may be a time. I get it. Like the Methodist church that I got married in, United Methodist Church, the United Global. So there are legitimate things, but it's we fall into, I think, a false religion that is a political religion that you discuss some of this kind of aspect of it. That if we're not careful, becomes idolatry, frankly.
Yes.
What are you seeing when you see some of the traps that we can fall into when politics become the religion almost?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, you know, so my first chapter, I describe what I call the four political religions right now. And the gist of this is just try to give a bit of a lay of the land, kind of where are we? And a lot of people I know, like myself, we've been asking, like, man, what just happened this last 10 years, you know? And so it's just trying to I'm trying to be descriptive here, not prescriptive yet. So I'm not necessarily saying what we do with this, but just trying to give some categories that I've found, I think, can help make sense. These are categories we used with our church in the last election season, and we found it really helpful just for people to kind of locate where we're at. And so you think of these four religions like this. We tend to think of left, right, right? Like the left and right political spectrum, which is true. But if you can also imagine, for listeners, you can imagine like a top-down axis. So not just the left-right axis, but a top-down axis, which is like modernity at the top and post-modernity at the bottom. And part of the argument I want to make is that the shift from modernity to post-modernity has split some of the traditional political divide, which helps make sense of why some of the deepest fighting we see is not just right versus left, but it's different camps on the right and different camps on the left. So the first political religion would be in the upper left quadrant. So you think modern left, I call this the religion of progress. And the creed here is we can change the world. So there's a strong faith in like scientific discovery, technological advancement, strong institutions, higher education, research, public policy. This religion is prominent. You can think of places like Silicon Valley or Google and Facebook. The high priest would be folks like Steve Jobs, Bill Gates. Think of the smartphone and the tech boom, artificial intelligence, medical breakthroughs. The worship leader in this quadrant might be like Bono, right? Well, I love Bono. I love you too, right? But yeah. Since he's rallying the faithful, we can change the world. We can use science, technology, institutions to make the world a better place.
Question on that. Would that include a strong sense of activism?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To the point of protest, maybe?
Well, so yes, though I would say that in the upper quadrant, you know, that the part of the what makes it modern is that there's still a strong belief in like institutions and science and these things can get us there and kind of the institutions and structure. And, you know, I think the temple of this quadrant, if you will, is like the university and especially the STEM department, like science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Right. This is where you can ascend the ranks to, you know, transform the world.
Okay.
And if we go to the upper right quadrant now, so the modern right, I call this the religion of responsibility. And so here the creed is, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, right? Where there's a strong faith in this quadrant in personal potential and hard work, good moral values, taking responsibility for yourself and those closest to you in the free market, business entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. We can think of this quadrant, you know, think of, you know, it's predominant maybe in location like the suburbs. And we can think of the high priest as historically someone like Ronald Reagan or Newt Gingrich, kind of the public herald, right? When I was growing up.
Yeah.
Yes, totally. A little blue collar as well. Yes, yeah. And today I'd suggest the baton has been passed to figures like Jordan Peterson. You know, he says, if you want to change the world, you start by making your bed. You take responsibility for yourself. Yeah. Or public figures like Jocko Willink, if listeners are familiar with him, or David Goggin, who talk about the values of extreme ownership, taking responsibility for yourself and those around you. And the temple in this quadrant, I'd suggest, is maybe the house with the white picket fence, where this is kind of the reward for the faithful who live their responsibility well, can, you know, receive their just recompense. And as I was growing up, these felt like kind of the two camps, right? You know, they have the progress camp, the responsibility camp in terms of emphasis. And again, I'm not trying to be critical at this stage, just describe, because progress, those are good values, right? But if we talk now about the shift modernity to post-modernity, what do I mean by that? in short, you know, all of the philosophy majors are going to slap me right now for how simplistic I'm about to be, but
they don't watch the show. They don't watch the show.
They don't watch the show. Sorry, great. But I think we think of the modernity as like the scientist in a lab coat, right? He is, you know, where there's this interest in the enlightenment, reason, and scientific method, building strong institutions, solving the world's problems, very optimistic about human potential. But as we shift now to postmodernity is really a reactionary movement that saw a lot of modernity's failures. So it saw things like the world wars or nuclear weapons or evil things like eugenics that were done in the name of science and progress. And so now there's a suspicion of institutions, of science, of those values of modernity and things. And so I think the image that we could use here is the picture of an artist who's painting a picture of themselves as the artist, where there's a high emphasis on like creative self-expression, on looking within and expressing themselves to the world. And so if modernity was about discovering and defining the world, postmodernity is about constructing and creating one's own world. And so if we go to the lower left quadrant, postmodern.
Question on that. So is that,
right, please.
Is that the I have my truth, you have your truth kind of crowd, as opposed to the ones that saying, let's all go find the truth?
Great. Yes, exactly. Okay. Exactly. So lower left quadrant, I would call this the religion of identity, whose creed is, as you just mentioned, is live your truth.
Okay.
You know, like live your life. You do you. Don't let anyone tell you how to live. And we can think of this religion as predominant in more like the urban core. You know, we can think of places like San Francisco and Boston, or race and gender yard signs here in Portland, where I live, you know, and everybody's right around, you know, or we can think of leading figures, high priests like Ta-Nehisi Coates or Elliot Page. There's this pessimism towards the ideas and institutions of modernity, but now there's still a desire for progress, like the upper left, but we no longer trust those things to get us there. And so now, instead of looking without, we look within and from the internal to discover and express one's most authentic desires. That's kind of how, in this quadrant, this is how we're going to change the world. And so we see this in like TikTok and Instagram posts, the strong ethos of self-expression, or as you mentioned, that's just the temple in this quadrant would be the protest, right? Like where the voice of the people, the vox populi, can register their disillusionment with the institutions and the mainstream society to go a different way. The preachers in this quadrant, I would suggest, are figures like pop icons, like Lady Gaga and Lil Nas X, who are modeling the way of salvation in this quadrant through performative self-expression and continual reinvention of oneself. Prophets in this quadrant would be leaders like political leaders like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's proclaiming the gospel of the world will be saved through deconstructing and dismantling all the institutional roadblocks that keep people from being their authentic selves. And so that's how I'd kind of, you know, this one. And again, we're just trying to describe them at this stage. But, you know, in Portland, you know, I see a strong ideological pull many feel towards this quadrant. And then if we go to the final one, the lower right, this is what I call the religion of security, where the creed here is good fences make good neighbors. And so there's a sense in this quadrant of, man, we live in a dangerous world. We need boundaries, borders, keep people safe. Like security allows us to prosper. Like as insiders, we share codes of conduct, rules of behavior for how we live together. And we can think of this quadrant as strong in places like the heartland, or you think of hometown identity, jobs shipped overseas. You think of Detroit and the decline of manufacturing, leaders like Sarah Palin, Tucker Carlson. Think of Appalachia and the epidemic of meth addiction and unemployment. And what makes this quadrant, you know, postmodern is, again, there's a strong suspicion and pessimism towards the ideas and institutions of modernity.
Yeah.
So you'll hear the rhetoric of, man, like, you know, the deep state government wants to take away your rights. A big pharma, they're pushing their medicine, their pills, their vaccines on you. The fake news media, it's out to deceive you. The elites are out to get you. And whatever one thinks of all that, you know, there's an inherent suspicion, like the lower left, towards kind of the institutions and all of modernity. And
it's the contrails. The contrails.
Yes, yeah. Definitely. And there's still a sense of,
Sorry.
That's great. Yeah. And there's still a sense of responsibility, like the upper quadrant, or upper right, only here the responsibility, it's not to kind of some universal objective moral norms or goods. It's rather more of a loyalty to one's immediate kind of tribe or inside folks and all. And so, you know, I had a friend who was talking about this, and he's like, man, you know, I actually feel like I saw a lot of these same themes growing up in 90s hip hop culture with, you know, say like with gangs, where there was a message of like, man, the streets are dangerous. The police are out to get you. Society just doesn't understand you. Like, we need to stick together. Yeah. Our safety's at stake. There's a loyalty, not so much to a sacred code out there, but to one another in here, the insiders. Patriotic signs like gang colors, tattoos that show, hey, I'm an insider. The cardinal sin is being a narc or a snitch or a traitor who's betraying one's crew. And here I'd suggest the temple is the nation itself, right? Like, there's a sense of there are heretics who need to be kind of shamed and called back to the ancient paths. There are corrupt leaders who need to be overthrown because they're defiling the sanctuary in DC. There's hostile invaders at the gate who need to be repelled with a stronger enforcement of our sacred borders. And pretty much, as I see, you know, the polls, like, the vast majority of Americans believe like immigration reform is desperately needed. But I think it helps explain why that is such a focal issue in this quadrant, is it taps into these themes of security and loyalty and all. And in sum, so that was a mouthful, those four quadrants, but in sum, I would say that all four of those are good values in their proper place, that we actually see in the Garden of Eden and in God's, the biblical story, progress, identity.
Legitimately, I can go and look at those and go, here's a scriptural aspect to this quadrant and this quadrant and this, some easier than others. And I can also go to all of those and go, and here's an unscriptural tendency in each of these quadrants. So
yes,
while I see your analysis, I think it's very astute. What do we do with it?
Great. Yeah. So one of the taglines, so that's chapter one. The rest of the book kind of goes into like, how do we live? How then shall we live? And one of the key takeaways I say is, you know, to bring your lean, but submit your bow. Right? That I believe the gospel that Jesus called us to bring our lean, but submit our bow. The lean being our political kind of perspective, right? Like, we all are going to have a leaning towards one of these quadrants, and that's okay. I'm not saying that, again, there are gifts that each of those quadrants has to bring to the table, but to submit our bow. And a bow is more like where we're giving our ultimate allegiance, and even questioning, being attentive to, man, is there an ideology at play? Because right now, it's just in our country, there are people in each of those quadrants spending billions of dollars trying to captivate our attention and pull our allegiance ultimately into the aims of that quadrant in ways that can become idolatrous and destructive. And so I do think it starts with pledging our allegiance to Jesus, first and foremost, as the King of Kings, the King who's higher. Like, you could ask, where does Jesus fit in those quadrants? Which one is he in? And I would suggest Jesus doesn't belong to those values. Those values belong to him.
Right? Like, that's it.
Like, progress. Yeah. Like, those values belong to Christ as King. And so giving our ultimate allegiance to him. And one of the things that I love in Jesus's ministry is how he gathers a group of politically diverse disciples. You know, he's got a zealot and a tax collector. He's got blue collar fishermen and white collar doctors, right? And he's pulling these people from different backgrounds. And that may not sound like much to us today. Back in the day, like, the zealots and tax collectors wanted to kill each other. Like, zealots were wanting to overthrow the system, revolutionaries, and tax collectors were like working for the man. They were seen as compromisers who were profiting off the backs of their people.
Totally.
And so Jesus calling them both, I mean, that's like him inviting, you know, a Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street protester and a Wall Street executive into a small group, or calling Ben Shapiro and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or whatever into a small group together and going like, hey, all right,
love one another.
I know you guys don't see eye to eye, but love one another. And I like to imagine those campfire conversations had to be crazy, you know, like where they were processing stuff, because those leanings didn't go away overnight when they stepped into this kingdom. And so I think that one of the telltale signs that your lean has become a bow, I give a bunch of different signs in the book, but one big one I think is our quickness to break fellowship over a difference in political leaning, you know, like how quick we are, like that story I shared at the beginning of the church that fractured, how quick people were to assume the worst, to break fellowship, to slander, to, you know, I think that's a big warning sign.
So when my wife and I have moved since the last election, and where we bought a house, I'm in Texas, and it's not that it's all conservative, because certainly there's Austin, but where I moved, I know, because others have told me, that I have one neighbor that had a Trump sign in his yard, one neighbor that had a Biden sign in their yard, okay? And I think, you know, I was like, oh, you know. And so I'm going to obviously disagree politically with one of the two, right?
Yes.
And the reality is I have a great relationship with both neighbors. I literally have taken care of one neighbor's dog while they were gone and taken care of the other neighbor's pool while he was gone, you know. Kind to both of them, I could, and they're kind to me. And and I think one of the measures of whether your politics have become an idol is if you can't love your neighbors equally when you got one of each, right?
Yes.
Is that a pretty good heart check when we where are we at?
Definitely. No, I think that's great. You know, I give one of the things I give, and there's two chapters in what I call the 10 political commandments, right? And these are, you know, we use these in the last election season at our church, and we jokingly call them the 10 political commandments because we didn't want to get them confused with the actual 10 commandments God gives Moses on Mount Sinai. But going, these are things that God commands us as his people in scripture. And these 10 commandments, they're not so much about like how to vote or what opinions to hold, but rather about how to hold those opinions well. I mean, I do talk in the book about, I do think there are areas that scripture is clear of values that we should hold and whatnot, you know, that impact our politics. But this is really more about what kind of posture we have towards those who disagree even. And so, I mean, just to give an example, the first two commandments, and number one is worship. Like, I commit my allegiance to King Jesus over all idols and ideologies. Yeah. Like, I think if we started at that place, you know, like, that would change everything. The second one is love of neighbor. Like, I commit to participating in civic life as a means of loving and serving my neighbor rather than just serving my own interests. And it goes through, and there's other ones like, you know, the image of God and biblical wisdom, fruitful speech, biblical justice, on peacemaking, removing the log, humble learning, and loving our enemies. But I think it's going, even with our convictions that we hold, if we held them with this kind of posture, I think would radically change the game. And these are not optional. I think for some people, they might go, you know, if you're a Christian, you might go, well, those are for your personal life, but they don't apply out here in the real world of politics. And going, no, God didn't give an exception clause. You know, like, these are things God commands us as his people in terms of how we live. And as you're saying, I think living this would give us the freedom and the power to love our enemies, to love our neighbors, the one with the Trump sign and the one with the Biden sign in our next door front yards, you know, like that we could actually model a different way. And I think actually we live in a culture right now that's actually very hungry for that, because, you know, the impression if you just live online is that everyone is so extreme. But a lot of studies have found what they call the silent majority, that a lot of the online discourse is driven by the most extreme 10% or so on each side, and 80% or so of folks are frustrated with the fracture and polarization and are silent because they don't want to get beat up verbally by saying anything, but are really hungry for more of a mature, humble, coming together a different kind of way. And so I think it's an opportunity for the church to lead in cultivating that kind of a
100%. And what's funny is this time there's really no mystery. I mean, it's Trump and Biden. And I guess, you know, if Trump goes to jail, then we might have another nominee, or if Biden is not capable to fulfill the duties of the office, they would have another nominee. But we don't have a lot of the political suspense we have right now. A lot of people I know, and these are people that care about politics in general, they're just kind of like tuned out. You know, they're like, I don't really want anything to do with that right now. And so, again, it produces an opportunity to maybe have some conversations about some what we call political topics, which politics just is creeping into everything these days, unfortunately. But to have some civil conversation. In other words, it's a good chance to practice without having necessarily, you know, all this team rah-rah, I'm on this, because there's no primaries, you know, primaries are done, right? So I think if we could put into practice what God says to do in the political season, it just pays dividends in life, you know. And I really think it's what we're called to do. I want to show people real quick a couple things. Again, this is The Party Crasher by Joshua Ryan Butler, available right now wherever you get books. A good thing to keep, just, we got to keep that compass pointed north, right? This is also his website, which is at joshuaryanbutler.com. So you can follow up with him if you want to. I have one question, and this one isn't in the notes. When you have someone that you disagree with, that you know you disagree with, what role, because I know it's important, I want to ask that. What advantage is it to become a good listener instead of just a good speaker to, well, let me yes. tell you what I think, as opposed to tell me what you think, right?
Yes. Oh man, I think it's huge. You know, in the last election season, one of the pieces of guidance I gave our pastors, our leadership team at our church, was saying, you know, I think the biggest thing I found is that most people just want to be heard, you know? And when someone has a gripe, a complaint, I found how often if I just reach out and say, hey, can we meet up or can we hop on the phone or whatever? And just asking questions, seeking to listen, and they might come in just hot, you know, with an email or with the whatever, and they're fired up and they're whatever because they're hearing things or reading things through a grid. But once they feel heard, I find 95% of the time it's just temperature right. goes down and they're, oh, thank you. You know, and that, I think that has a massive power to de-escalate some of the intensity in the room, just the ability to become good listeners.
Most people would agree with you, but we act like they would rather be told than heard.
It's, yes.
It's this weird kind of human thing. And I've done it. And until someone pointed out and said, actually, they just wanted you to listen to them, not to tell them. And I was like, but I didn't. But, and you go back and replay it, and you go, oh, yeah, I just told when all they wanted was to be heard.
Yes, totally.
Yeah. So self-awareness would be very beneficial. And most of all, as Joshua pointed out, the keeping God, who God says we are, as opposed to who the political manipulators want to say we are, or we even want to say we are, yeah. and for the sake, it's the only way that's going to keep us from totally splitting apart, which division is not of God ultimately. Anyway, all right. Anything else you need to add? I could go on all day on this kind of thing, but I'm with you in that we have to be good, even at this, in order to be effective as a church. Anything else?
No, that's, yeah. Well, you know, I think one final thought, you know, I threw out there is, man, one thing I talk about in the book as well is like, man, if you're someone who does get fired up a lot about politics and you know, that one of the things that we've challenged our people to that I found really productive is let's focus locally, you know, like, yes, cast your vote nationally, do that piece. Like that's great. But I found, man, there's something powerful when we take all that energy, that emotion, that whatever, and we get involved in our local community. You know, last election season, we started some things we call prayer and action groups, which were challenging people that like going, hey, if you're getting really fired up right now in the political season, we want to invite you to one of these groups. We started two. One was on sanctity of life. Another one was on criminal justice, going, okay, here's an issue on the left and on the right that people tend to really care about on each side. But we had, you know, a dozen, 12, 15 people jump into each group, and they committed to a year. We're going to intentionally pray about this issue, and we're going to learn. We're going to invite in local leaders who are doing good work in our community on this. We're going to read the best stuff, and then we're going to find a concrete action that we can take in our city that's constructive, that can help lead us as a church in getting constructively involved. And there was just powerful fruit that came out of that. And I actually think that, yes, again, cast your vote nationally, but I think if we poured a lot of the time, intention, and energy that can go into that conversation nationally, you know, into our local communities as the church, we could really have a powerful impact right where we live.
So here's the thing about what you're saying is that that's not just, you know, a good outlet. That actually is the only way an individual is going to affect any change is locally, for the most part. It's going to be the rare individual that elevates to the level of a national political campaign, and it's a handful. So for the 99.99% of us, if you actually want to have any impact, it's what you're saying right there.
Yeah.
All right. Again, yeah. You can tell. I do get fired up about this. So let's do it again. I appreciate the conversation. The Party Crasher is the book, and Jesus is the Party Crasher. So let him disrupt your party, whether it's blue or red or something else in between. And let's really keep the focus where it should be, especially during a political season. Look, this summer might get crazy again. We'll just see. It could get really crazy. It is critical. Seriously, I know I'll laugh and joke, but it is critical that we keep Christ at the forefront and that we preach Christ above all else and live it. So Again, appreciate you, Joshua, being here. People check you out at joshuaryanbutler.com. And please come back to Life Today Live, even if you don't like this conversation. We'll have other good ones for you. But we are going to address all these things. And if you haven't liked, followed, subscribed, please do that. Hit the share button and come back. We'll see you again here next time on Life Today Live.
Are we safe to America? Be true to what you said on paper.